Hello, everyone. We're on. And guess what episode this is? I happen to know that because Jan just told me. It's episode 65. And it's a very special one because we have a guest. So I'm Joe Atwell. I'm here with my co-host Jan Irvin, and we have Jacob Dulman. Welcome, Jacob.
Thank you for having me. I just touched my microphone.
Hopefully. Yeah, you don't want to grab your mic while we're talking, dude.
Thank you for me. I was just in the audio. It's a very bad habit from listening to your podcast outside. I was.
Yeah. We want to talk to Jacob about basically.
Well, let's back up a second because, you know, we had, now what was his name? That guy that we had on recently.
Horsley.
No. Now I'm James Campbell. And, you know, and James Campbell, he had gone out based on the show and he was talking to some people sitting at dinner one day and they, you know, the grandmother said, well, I knew Wasson and yada, yada, yada. And pretty soon he's at these people's house looking at the Wasson archives and everything. And he was able to pull up all this original research that, you know, would have probably been lost forever if he hadn't have done that. And, you know, we had put out, Joe had asked me to put out a request for research help last week, which I had posted on Facebook. And you had just dug in, Jacob, and, you know, and really came back with some amazing stuff. And this is really, you know, what it's all about. And while you, you know, look like a professor sitting there with all your library and everything right behind you and your beard and glasses and all, you're in fact not a professor, are you?
No, not at all. my friends might beg to differ just because of the way I am. This is actually thanks to you, this library. I started collecting it when I started the Trivium studies. How long ago was that? 4 or 5 years ago now, probably. When did you have Gino Denning on the show?
Oh, that was 7+ years ago.
I caught it a couple of years probably after you put that on because I saw you on Dave Asprey's show, Bulletproof Radio. And then I was like, oh, this young guy seems pretty interesting. So I started following your show after that, got really heavily into the Trivium. And I decided if I'm going to have a family someday in my life, I need to have books that I can hold in my hand and put in a bookshelf and keep forever because all I need is one EMP blast and all tech's gone. All our digital books are gone. No more data. There's no more information. There's no more education. So kind of went off on a tangent there, known to do that.
No, but it's a very useful one.
Well, you know, the point is, though, is that, you know, the idea is to encourage people, everyday people, to go out and find valid research and to feel confident in being able to do that. I mean, I started at one point, Joe started at one point, you know, we just didn't have it all our lives. I decided I wanted to write a book, and then once I started writing, I was writing stuff, and then it was like, well, how do I check this now that I'm writing it, you know? And then I had to start dealing with citations and all of this stuff, and so that was a whole new thing. And sorry, just turning off some other windows that were accidentally open, but learning that, okay, well, I can just go track this stuff out and follow the leads and you know, until everything is flushed out and there's nothing left. And basically, over the last couple of weeks, and you were already familiar with Trivium, but over the last couple of weeks, you had really done a lot of research on Brigadier General Thomas Harrison.
Yeah, it's only the tip of the iceberg, too.
And it's only the tip of the iceberg. So anyway, go ahead. Why don't you know, both of you go ahead. And
actually, no, Jacob, why don't you give us like a little update on the research you're doing and any conclusions or you know, conjectures you're able to draw out of it?
Well, before we get started on that, I think you asked me like what I do, and I kind of went off on that tangent. I just bring it back full circle really quick before I go off on that and we really get off on the details. I studied English at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I have a bachelor's degree. I also work in a different, completely different industry now. I work in aggregate industries, in a rock crusher repair shop. So down in the rock quarries, those machines that break down all the stone and bring that aggregate material so we can have the beautiful society we have right now. I help repair those machines in a repair shop and do some engineering and kind of a jack of all trades, a little bit of everything I kind of touch on. But anyway, that's my background.
So you fix rock crushers, gigantic rock crushers.
Yes, indeed. They're massive. And then we don't even fix the largest ones. Like, we just usually do secondary and tertiary rock crushers.
Wow. Primary ones. Yeah, and I've seen, like, photos of those things. Like, they're like a tower that's, like, 60 stories tall next to, like, a pickup truck or something.
Yeah, they just dump those things down. I have an uncle that drives those trucks. It's not fun. Well, actually, it is fun, but if you get caught in the weight the wrong way, you'll come tumbling down in a big heap. But anyway, where were we? Tom Harrison.
Okay. Yeah, your mass observation and all that stuff.
Okay, so, you guys asked for...
You know what? We're getting feedback all of a sudden. Joe, can you kill your speakers? Okay, go ahead. There's still feedback coming from somewhere. I don't know where.
I don't have any audio on my earbuds.
This happened last week, too. And Joe, are your speakers down far enough?
Yeah, they should be. They're registering this in the lowest possible range, so there shouldn't be any feedback at all from them.
Okay, try again, Jacob.
Okay. Seems like we're fine now. I don't have any.
Now it's gone. Yeah. All right.
So last week you gave that request to try to find that poem. So I got a little bug just went in my head and I was like, I need to find that poem because I studied English literature when I was in college and I was like, it'd be really interesting to see this philosophy of cannibalism written down in a poem, see how the imagery comes out. Maybe we'll be able to find something with it. So I first started trying to find copies of the New Statesman. Couldn't find any anywhere. There weren't any archives. And I wasn't about to just start spending money on the New Statesman to access the archives for a lemon that might not be there. So I decided to find third ways of finding it, tertiary ways or secondary ways. And that was to just search Coconut Moon, Tom Harrison, go into all the search engines and try to find as much information as I could and just read, just keep reading until I find something that's interesting. And that the article about ornithology out of the Journal of Geography? I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head right now. That had said it was in his book, Surviving or Savage Civilization. So I started doing some digging. I couldn't find a digital copy initially. So I bought the book and it still hasn't arrived, which is kind of annoying because I bought something on Amazon today and it came to my doorstep today. That's a different story.
Yeah, so I'm actually showing that on the screen here too while we're going. I'm showing Savage Civilization, just so you both know.
So I went on archive.org and I just figured maybe I'll just search Tom Harrison's name. And that was the only thing that popped up was Savage Civilization, which really troubled me because I kept searching in all the search terms for the name of the book and Tom Harrison, and never showed up. So archive kind of failed there and putting on Google and all the other stuff, but that's okay. We found it and shared the poem and that's where the rabbit hole started. I guess where could we start? I mean, I found that documentary by David Attenborough, who worked with him on the Borneo story documentary that he made in the 1950s with a man by the last name of Gibb. And that sort of revolutionized documentary filmmaking in its own right. Because of just the amount of work that they had to do to get
talking
cameras.
About the Borneo headhunters,
yeah, right. the Borneo story, yeah. So that was just really fascinating to see that, and then I found the Barefoot Anthropologist, great documentary. David Attenborough, used to work with him, and I'm usually better with written words than spoken words, so you're gonna have to bear with me sometimes here because I have a mind that races a million miles an hour.
Right.
Let's see. Let me collect my thoughts here really quick.
Do you have a brain database?
I do not. That's something I really need to invest in and do. Let me pull up my Gmail here really quick. That actually has a lot of my research notes in it.
Sure. Well, Joe, what did you discover with this Coconut Moon poem?
Well, I'll actually be coming out with a written analysis of the typology in it. I was interested in it, trying to get a hold of it, because it had appeared on... the page that had a letter from Mange, M-A-N-G-E, who was basically declaring the founding of mass observation. Okay, this absolutely bizarre so-called science of ourselves, which came about because the British working class was having rebellions. And so for some reason, Mange decided this would be the right time to start this mass observation. And I was interested in mass observation because of the potential links to the Beatles. mass observation got into focusing on dance halls. And one of the books of sort of anthropologic understanding of British dance halls, for example, references mass observation over 75 times, 75 citations of different scientific conclusions about the behavior of dance halls. And then what really caught my eye was Ackland, who was working with a group that was ancillary but connected to mass observation. He made this statement. He goes, you know, in the study of dance halls, we've really seen how it controls populations and things like this. I'm paraphrasing. But he says, we should go and meet with people who write their tunes, their music, because we should be able to like get some control over them and see what we can do about it. And then he came up with a lyric. And the lyric, he says, I can just hear people, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting, but the last part I will quote. He said the lyric would be, when will they let us build a better world, right? And that just rang a bell in my head. I go, wait a second. This is like the Beatles songs. You know, where did this lyric is very, very troubling because of the just the kind of the nature of the, you know, of how the kind of the politics are set up. You know, the young people are fighting against this entrenched bureaucracy that is evidently evil, and we have to rebel, and we can make a better world, and we should come together as a group. You know, it all just seemed pretty pat. And so it turned out that mass observation had actually been a fusion of two different groups or projects. And one of them, Harrison, had started. Harrison had actually started a kind of evidently a smaller study that was suspiciously similar to what mass observation becomes. But he, for some reason, and this is the thing which just, I mean, I knew this was a red flag when I read it. He had his poem, Coke at Noon, A Philosophy of Cannibals, printed directly underneath Mange's letter announcing mass observation. And this was supposedly before they got together. And so I said, man, this looks pretty weird to me, pretty suspicious. I sure would like to get this Coke at Noon moon business, because cannibalism is an absolutely key concept, a key typology in trying to understand the secret society. The secret society has a brand of humor that is related to and plays off of, but is in opposition to the Roman humor in Christianity that I claim exists in, you know, in things like eating of my flesh and drinking of my blood. If you don't know if you've read Caesar's Messiah, but I have this whole thing outlining this Roman humor about cannibalism. Well, in modern, you know, typology, they link to this. Like if you look at the cannibalism in zombie films, right? Very, very often it's related to an apocalypse, or they'll have a messiah. You know, they'll put these scenes in churches. You know, so they're basically making fun of Christians that they, you know, see as unwittingly engaging in cannibalism. So this is my perspective. And so when I saw Harrison's A Philosophy of Cannibals, you know, at the beginning of mass observation, I was really wondering about it. And the only thing I'll say about it is that before I, you know, finish the paper, is just that it's basically the poem is about a dying race. The cannibals are actually about to disappear. They're at the end of it, there's only going to be one left. And he's asking for a little like plot of land to live in, because his whole cannibal world is done away with. And there's lots of typology, in my opinion, concerning Christianity and the secret society and Freemasonry. It's all inside that. But Harrison is a really fascinating character. You know, he's one of the Masonic families that you really can't get your grips on. You know what I mean? If you study, like I have, I've tried to get in to understand the connection to Freemasonry. It's like with the Huxleys. I mean, sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out. I don't think that Freemasonry organizes the entire secret society. And this is one of the problems, is that they can blink and go in and out of other of organizations all over the place. I mean, they can be in Bohemian Grove, Skull and Bones, Freemasonry, or none of them, right? I mean, Gordon Wasson, he's not in these things. He's, you know, works for MKUltra, but They have, I think, family connection.
Well, he was Century Club, which is still one of the clubs.
He was Century Club, but, you know, no one even knew the Century Club was really related to Bohemian Grove until Jan Ervin really pointed this out. This wasn't something that was common knowledge. So my point is that the secret society is organized unto itself. When we see the manifestations like Skull and Bones or high-level Freemasonry, we're not looking at the whole picture. We're just seeing a little aspect of it, and these guys can blink in and out. And Harrison, I think, is one of these guys, like I think Mange is, certainly like Lockwood and Epstein, you know, the manager and person that hired the Beatles, you know. I mean, these guys, you can kind of make this sort of sense out of them, but Harrison really deserves, I think, a lot of investigation because of his anthropologic work, you know, because he comes to a lot of, like, I'll give you one example I really want to do research into is that Harrison claims that there's pedophilia in the cannibal culture, just like Margaret Mead claimed that there was early sexual activities in the Samoans. I really want to see the documentation of this because I've seen this, quite a few anthropologists produce this bogus pedophilia, you know, kind of.
And sex history. Yeah, go ahead, Jacob.
I'm sorry to be long-winded, but that's my thought on that. So.
There's actually an interesting point to make with that because you said you wanted to get the documentation.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Tom Harrison did not keep notes. He did not write anything. From what I understand correctly, the only thing he wrote while he was on that island was Coconut Moon, the poem.
I think that's correct. Right.
No. I read that in the book that you sent us.
And so then he could have just made up whatever.
Yeah. Right. And it's also, it's sort of like when you look at William Burroughs in the Amazon, jungle, and he discovers like the ancient ayahuasca culture, you know, and it goes all the way back to time. He talks about how it's so ancient. Now there's only one problem. There's only one guy left. There's only one shaman left. Here's the last one. So if you want to like replicate his steps to try to get to the, you know, this culture, unfortunately, there's only one guy and he's dead. So that's the end of that. But it is an ancient culture. It goes way back in time. He talks about how ancient it is in this video he did on it. And so, you know, this is, you know, it's just like we've been attacked with weaponized anthropology. I mean, that, to me, it's just clear as a bell. Mm-hmm. So one thing we got to do is go back and like look at all the anthropologic claims that people make about, you know, culture to see what was a weapon and what's real.
Well, yeah. And what we really need to do is just go right to the forefathers and mothers of anthropology, you know, go through Mead stuff, Bates and stuff, Malinowski, Harrison, etc., and really analyze what each of these people did. And it's probably that originally, you know, a cell was formed around Malinowski with Mead, etc. Who knows how far up the chain of command that Malinowski was. But everything at this point, you know, as far as all of this sexual cannibalism, yada yada stuff going on, children having sex, etc., that's then picked up by Mead and by Wilhelm Reich, et cetera. And Wilhelm Reich was also under Malinowski, and they're all right there in that same little hub. Then it all spreads out. Yeah. And then we see almost the identical theme happening with Harrison. And then I, you know, as I was reading, going through Harrison's book there, whatever it's called.
Savage Civilization.
Yeah, Savage Civilization. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, it occurred to me that his whole theme sounded so similar to Malinowski. So I did a little bit of research on him. And in fact, he had done some research with Malinowski, Bronislaw Malinowski. The first year's work, 1937-1938. And then Madge and Harrison were both editors of that for Mass Observation, which published Malinowski's book there. So, yeah, you know, we had this
of connections. They're all linked together. Exactly right, Young. Good spot.
Right. You know, so, you know, it was just a hunch, you know, because I had studied Malinowski years ago and I thought, my God, this sounds awfully familiar. But yeah, I mean, we can see all of this stuff coming out of him. Here's Wilhelm Reich. You know, here's we have him related to Harrison, to Meade, etc. And these are basically the key founders of this weaponized anthropology with Meade's husband, Gregory Bateson, who helped found the CIA, being right at the center of it.
I want Jacob, can you, I mean, it's like Jan and I could easily get carried away here, you know, but I really am so curious about your research and the things that you've seen and want to. Can you, are you?
There's some fireworks going off right now in my head.
I didn't mean to, like, I hope we're not taking you into a tangent and away from the stuff you want to talk about. But anyway.
No, I can listen to you guys talk all day.
Have the floor and let us know what you're.
So we're on, there are a couple angles here. We'll go back just a little bit to the poem and the publication first, because that's a little bit older in my mind. I want to get that out first. The poem, when it was published in the New Statesman, you know, this is around the same time where he's working with the Left Book Club to also publish this as a book, not just as a poem, but the poem inside the book and all the contents and everything. And if you look into the Left Book Club and Victor Gallant, I think that's probably pronounced his name. It Gallant, could be wrong. Yeah. You know, they were. I actually have a quote here from George Orwell's essays and stuff. He's writing about the Left Book Club, and I found some interesting information about it that might help give us an idea of what this publisher was, who they supported, and where their aims might have been, and why they might have somebody like Tom Harrison on board. This is a letter that Eric Blair, or George Orwell, wrote to his literary agent. I'm just going to pull it up here on the screen really quick. It's addressed to the Stores in Wellington. I'm really bad with the way English put out their addresses. I'm going to skip it and just say it was on the 15th of December in 1936 when he wrote this letter. And this is for Wigan Pier. He says, "Dear Mr. Moore, herewith is the manuscript for The Road to Wigan Pier. Parts of it I am fairly pleased with, but I should think the chances of Gallant choosing it as a Left Book Club selection are small, as it is too fragmentary and, on the surface, not very left-wing. Perhaps if it were sent on to him more or less at once, he might have a look at it or get someone else to do so before the Christmas holiday. But I suppose we are not likely to hear from him before I leave for Spain, which should be in about a week. Yours sincerely, Eric Blair." Now, there are a couple of footnotes that are attached to this. One was next to the Left Book Club. And the editors of this book, when they put it together, decided to say, "The Left Book Club, founded by Victor Gallant in May 1936, and Savage Civilization came out in 1937, I believe, right at the beginning of the year. So May 1936 and published by him was an anti-fascist, pro-Soviet, and for the Popular Front. Subscribers had to accept the monthly choice of the selection committee consisting of Victor Gallant, Harold Lasky, and John Strachey. By this time, the membership had reached 40,000 people." So when Savage Civilization came out, this was selected by a committee and chosen for people to read. So, I mean, this is a very specific book that they wanted to get out to a very specific part of the population, and they wanted this information to spread. And they also, this kind of seems to tie into a lot of the other stuff you guys studied with Fabian socialism, the Soviets, and a lot of the mind control that kind of comes out of that. So it's just kind of interesting.
One thing here. I think that the most important component that these people wanted to inject with this book is the pedophilia, because the book goes into a very long description of young men being basically, and I won't describe it because it's actually, you know,
it's disturbing
bounds of polite conversation.
Yeah, it's not but decent.
It's a very, very, creepy sexual relationship that Harrison claims exists in this culture, a pedophilic relationship, and the ones he's describing is insane to normal people. And so that, I think, is really what attracted this group to be able to want to put this book into our culture.
That could very much be a possibility. They definitely had a reason for wanting to put it out there and to a very select group of people. It was a very targeted market, and these people are very much involved with it. Be interesting to try to find more data to support that. And
well, you know how we can do this is the most natural place to look for a connection would be to the the Pedophile Exchange Club, I think it is, Jan, that one that Jason was talking about in his paper. There was an organization that basically in Britain had this, you know, was a way that pedophiles could connect to one another. Jason did quite a bit of research into it. It's written down in his paper, and he alludes to the fact that this was probably linked then to Jimmy Savile, and then on into the upper class, and on into this the British pedophilia.
Well, you know, doesn't that explain William Burroughs' Yage letters too, which is basically a pedophile map around South America with the ayahuasca cover.
Absolutely. See, this the themes are all kind of becoming clearer when you start to dust off the obscurity and all the kind of the misdirection that they have on the things. You get to see fake Indian cultures and pedophilia.
Right, you know, so that while it is Native revivalism, but they were already using it fully against our culture when Bateson even wrote that OSS later.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we've been victim of this thing for hundreds of years, as far as we can tell. And so what they're doing is they're justifying or they're socializing people to think that these are normal elements of culture.
Normalization, right. Yeah. Yeah, you can see that. I mean, weaponized anthropology. I mean, you can even find more specific examples from Tom Harrison to kind of show how anthropology can be weaponized.
Well, let's talk about, why don't we give an example, for instance, of the headhunters and what he did in World War II. Let's go into that for a minute.
Exactly. So during World War II, the Japanese had invaded Borneo and the British had lost control. And so at this point, many of the Dayak tribe had converted to Christianity because of a big influx of missionaries that had gone there. I think I might be getting the faith wrong, but I believe it was Presbyterian, but I could be wrong about that. A lot of the missionaries died. They were killed by the Japanese, and the people did not like that. They actually really liked missionaries that came there. They liked the quality of life that they helped provide and the education. So what happened when the Japanese invaded was the British were having trouble getting back into the country to try to fight them. So they flew in Tom Harrison, who was not in the military.
And he was like 19 at the time when they flew him in there, wasn't he?
That was the first time he went there. That was through Oxford. And that was for a trip through ornithology. This is probably, I think he was in his 30s at this time when he went back to Borneo. So this is, they got him. They knew he had the intelligence of the tribes and the people out there in the background to be able to go. And organize. So they put him in charge with no military training whatsoever. I mean, they just like, okay, put you in charge. If you watch the World War II Headhunters documentary, you can see how his men, the Barefoot Anthropologist is the one that has it in there. The Barefoot Anthropologist will tell you what his men thought of him. They didn't like him. They wanted to kill him. He was doing a lot of horrible stuff. I mean, he was taking control, was not following orders, was basically making his own commands to people and organizing it all on his own. He was in control. So what he did was he went up to the Dayak people eventually and decided, hey, we know we took away your religion and we outlawed headhunting. That was about 10 years prior to World War II when they outlawed it, I think, if my information is correct. So this was a very major part of the religion. The headhunting was sort of like, and they equated this in the documentary, it was sort of like Christianity going up for communion for the bread and the wine. So if you take away the bread and the wine, all of a sudden you remove the ceremony from the people. And you remove their heart, their soul.
Joe, you got to turn that back down. You just created a feedback loop again. Turn your speakers down, Joe.
So none of. Well, maybe I'll make sure we got the feedback here.
Turn the speakers down, Joe. You created a bad feedback loop. You got to keep it down.
I don't think it's my end, Jan, but could be.
Yeah, we both have headphones. You're the only one with speakers, dude. Turn it all the way down and then back up because it's on a feedback loop, please.
Well, also seems kind of interesting. Happens when we're talking about something that's kind of interesting.
God damn it!
I've done that in a couple of shows, you guys.
All right, just try to mute your mic for a minute, Joe, please. All right, go ahead, Jacob.
Okay. So where was I here? So the heart and the soul. So they had taken away the heart and soul of their religion, so they couldn't practice it anymore. Now, not all of the tribes people converted to Christianity. There are still pockets of them out there in the wilderness who had their own communities and still practiced their religion, but were outlawed from practicing the headhunting part of it. So Tom Harrison saw an opportunity to do some manipulation. He knew that the Japanese were invading. They were trying to find some American airmen who had crash landed. So he decided, we're going to be able to get these people out of here. We need to reinstitute headhunting. I'm getting that feedback again.
Yep. Yeah, I am too. I don't know what's going on. Joe, can you mute your microphone, please? It was off. It was not doing it there for a couple of minutes. All right, try that now. Yeah, it stopped. It's definitely Joe's side. There it goes again. I don't know what the hell.
We'll make do. I used to be in a band back in the day, so the feedback maybe will bring back some memories.
John, it isn't in mine because I unplugged it, and there was no sound whatsoever, and you're still getting it. So,
Well, it stopped right when you did that. It's not doing it now. Go ahead. It stopped. It stopped doing it, whatever you did. So go ahead, Jacob.
All right, so weaponized anthropology, headhunting, stealing the heart and soul of the Dayak tribes. So Tom Harrison decided, we're going to lose this battle if we don't start finding new methods of taking out the Japanese. We're not going to be able to take this land back. So he went to the Dayak tribes and said, hey, we'll do a deal. You guys can start headhunting again. We won't outlaw it, but there's only one catch. You can only headhunt the Japanese. So that's
Joe, whatever you're rubbing on is going into the mic there too. Sorry.
So he decided to, I'm sorry, I just lost my spot there in my train of thought.
I'm sorry, dude. Yeah. I was getting distracted because of all the noise.
I think you're on mute.
Yeah. Sorry. I got distracted too. Cause Joe's mouse or whatever was making all kinds of noise into the mic. So we lost the train of thought.
John, just to let it go, unless
it's you can't let it go, Joe, because it's a massive feedback loop. It's gone now. But if your speakers are too loud and the mic is too close to the speakers, it will feed back. That's why we use headphones.
Just work through it. We should do that because
you can't work through it, Joe, because it interrupts all thought. Anyway, Jacob, try to continue there. No.
Interrupting all thought is when we stop to do this like sound control thing. Anyway, let's ignore this and go on, okay?
Now your microphone is too low. You got to turn down your speakers and just mute your microphone with the button on the screen rather than altering all your volume settings. Go ahead, Jacob. Sorry.
Okay, so weaponized anthropology, the Dayak tribes, they were converted Christians, but all of them were the headhunters. Our headhunting was outlawed. Some of the tribesmen still practiced religion, but still couldn't headhunt, so they were longing for their religion back. So when Tom Harrison decided to have them just only go after the Japanese, I think some of the soldiers in the documentary were talking about how the woods became alive again, the jungle became alive again. You can hear the sounds of the tribesmen doing their dances, the repetitive noises of their drum beats. It was almost like their soul had been given back to them, and they were killing the Japanese with a lot of vigor. I mean, they would just take them out. Boom, 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 boom. Walking through the jungle, they'd pick off one guy in the end with a blow stick and a little bit of poison. He'd fall off. Nobody would miss him because nobody would hear him fall. Nobody would hear him scream or anything. So that's how they kind of headhunted. And that's how weaponized anthropology could be weaponized to the aims of the British. In the documentary, they actually said Tom Harrison used the traditions of the Dayak tribes for the British purposes to suit their needs. That's a great example of weaponized anthropology by using the traditions of somebody and using it for your benefit. They might think it's perfectly good and normal to them, but it could also be very harmful in the process at the same time.
Joe, you're going to have to speak up now. Your microphone is too loud. Like I said,
not interrupt me when I'm talking.
Joe, nobody can hear you.
I'm done and then interrupt me.
Turn up your goddamn mic, dude. Nobody can hear you. Nobody. Joe.
Okay.
And then interrupt me.
No one can hear you. You got to turn up your goddamn mic, dude.
You interrupt me, but otherwise I can't have a train of thought.
Turn up your goddamn mic once and for all.
Okay, wait a second. Hold on. You guys discuss and I'll turn up my mic. Hold on a second.
Dude, if no one can hear you, it doesn't matter what the hell you say, man.
Listen, it doesn't matter if I'm interrupted. There's not, I have nothing to say anyway. So can you hear me now?
I can kind of hear you, but you need to turn it up where it was and just use the mute button in Zoom.
Look, I'm telling you, it is not in my end. When I put the mute button on, nothing happens. I have exactly...
Okay, instead of arguing, turn up your mic volume again where it was, and let's continue.
Can you hear it?
You need to turn your microphone volume back where it was.
It's back where it was.
All right, then get closer to the microphone or something.
Well, wait a second.
There you go. Now it's up.
All right. I've lost my train of thought. Why didn't you pick it up, Jacob? Go ahead.
Well, what I just finished talking about was weaponized anthropology and how you could use the traditions of a culture to serve your own purposes. They might think what they're doing is perfectly fine and good, and it's a return back to what they wanted. But, you know, the British had taken it away from them initially and then given it back. So when you withhold something like that from somebody, you start to gain power. And then when you give it back, you gain even more power. So there seems to be like a give and take right there, what the British did, because it definitely increased the vigor of the Dayak tribes to go back out there and start headhunting again when they gave full go to go after the Japanese. So Tom Harrison knew what he was doing, and he did it well. I'm very curious to see how that man might have applied that elsewhere. And it seems like mass observation is a very, very, very good point to focus on because of how he studies the British people, and not just British people, but how much of Western civilization acts. How can you use those how people act in bars, sporting events, at the church, family functions and picnics? Yeah. How can they use that to serve their purposes? How can they, and while at the same time, the population is not knowing that anything is even wrong. So it's a good way to slowly cook a frog, it seems like. They don't even know.
And that's actually what was done. You know, one point that's interesting is this dance, the Lambeth Walk. Have you looked into that at all?
No, I haven't. All I know is just a very little bit of the details that he charted out in his book about how they danced and stuff, but yeah. I haven't looked any videos or anything.
Well, it was just the idea of creating a dance that would basically inspire the British to go to war. That was how it was characterized, you know, it's why they promoted it. And it's been studied actually by people after the fact. And, you know, people have wondered of whether or not there was some promotion by the government to create this dance, which featured a really kind of cocky strutting walk, which, you know, was manifesting this confident British perspective, which of course ends up with confidently walking out into automatic weapon fire, you know, and then getting mowed down. So that's, you know, just something. This was actually before mass observation, but it's just something in the stream of all of this weaponized anthropology that we, who are the group that must walk into the into the automatic weapon fire, needs to be aware of. Yeah, we need.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, that's why I hope that you continue this this study.
It's only the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's so thrilling just to be able to see this. He's such an interesting character. I mean, aside from the horror. I mean, they should have made a Hollywood movie about him, and they actually kind of did. It's called Farewell to the King, with starring Nick Nolte. They renamed him and just kind of based the character off of him. Nick Nolte didn't play him, but his co-star did. I can't remember the name of the actor off the top of my head.
Joe, really quickly, going off of what you were just saying, getting these guys to walk right into machine gun fire. And then you have the Tavistock Institute right there, who then studies shell shock, which becomes PTSD, and how to get soldiers right back out into the field, into the gunfire.
Yeah, well, if you look at mass observation and the funding for it, you'll see that Victor Gallant's...
Left Book Club, yeah.
That was actually something that helped fund mass observation. But the other source that's known was this Lord Simon. And Simon was the partner of Solly Zuckerman. Zuckerman was the psychologist who actually created the technology which then was used in the Dresden bombing, in the firebombing. Zuckerman basically had created technology or psychology, anthropology, that you know, could detect the kinds of bombing that would create the most terror, right? So again, you have just a clear-cut case of weaponized anthropology, that they actually were trying to create terror and panic. Now you could say, well, there's a military purpose for that, but regardless, you still have a direct connection into mass observation. This same group of individuals is you know, through Zuckerman and Simon, that you know, is involved in the starting of mass of funding of these projects inside of mass observation that Harrison was involved with.
That's kind of startling when you think about it, especially with the connection with Victor Gallant and Zuckerman in World War II, the Dresden bombings.
And then it goes directly on into the Beatles and into the Faith. I mean, like, you see, they can name these things whatever they want, but if you just focus on the actual science, when you look at like the Fabian Society, right? I mean, you know, like, what is that? Well, that's just basically cultural Marxism. I mean, we have different names for it here, you know, political correctness and whatnot, but the Fabian Society just had this, you know, a justification for very intense political control that it was trying to set up. And then it had the same groups of people, the ones that were involved in mass observation and the Fabian Society, are then involved in the London School of Economics, right? They, yep. They actually, the Rothschild family, Simon, all of these guys then, through the Fabian Society, create this this educational institute, the London School of Economics. Now I'm going to give you like a little, I don't know if you know this, Jacob, but this is really like an amazing bonbon. London School of Economics was the funding source for the Rolling Stones.
Yep, I knew that, yeah.
Oh, did, okay, so.
Well, because I think Mick Jagger went to school there, I believe, didn't he?
Right.
He did, and
they, as did Gordon Wasson.
Yep, that's right.
And so did Joseph Lasky, who is part of the Left Book Club.
Yeah, so.
He's one of the chairmen. Yeah,
it's a large organization, but the funding of a band, right, as a business project is completely unique. And the idea that it was just circumstance that the one group that they decided to fund, being the Rolling Stones, which basically is the counterpart to the Beatles, is preposterous, right? I mean, that's just, that fails because of the context. It fails because when you look at all of the weaponized anthropology you can demonstrate in the counterculture with the Beatles and things, then when you see that this group, right, the relationship, the financial relationships between mass observation, the Fabian Society, London School of Economics, and then you go, well, wait a second, then they are the group that then funds the Rolling Stones. All I can say is, well, you can understand now why Keith Richards wears the skull and bones on his ring. I mean, this is another Masonic, you know, organization, the Rolling Stones. As an example, like Jumping Jack Flash, that song, the lyrics are basically play off of The Mental Traveler by the, you know, crazed Freemason William Blake. So, you know, what are these guys doing, you know, riff kind of material, if in fact there isn't something in back of it? And then as soon as you get the context right of, well, these people are funding this and that, and here are the Stones. I mean, basically the Stones were just like Harrison bringing back cannibalism to the people. You know, I mean, it's just a clear case in my mind of this use of science to, you know, debase culture, take culture in a direction that they want, that's useful to them.
It certainly seems like there's a cannibalism theme that kind of runs through this, because it's not just like the literal act of eating something, but there's also the metaphor, like you're eating your own culture, you're eating away the things that make you whole and what you are. So it almost seems like studying what you guys research and what you've gone through, cultures seem to be devouring themselves and falling apart.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a cultural cannibalism of the whole society just collapsing in on itself into the fall, essentially. Right. You know, if you look at, in fact, I cited in my Entheogens What's in a Name article this whole discussion between Aldous Huxley and Tim Leary, where they're talking about using drugs and creating the fall and having a good old laugh about it.
We haven't even brought up the Huxley with Harrison. I totally forgot about that.
That's a really important dialogue. That's such an important point, because then when you look at movies like The Road or the zombie apocalypse stuff, you can see that there just is an organization that has kind of an understanding of symbolism and has a purpose and a goal, right? This isn't just a secret language that they're having fun playing off of. I mean, it's the language of their triumph, of what their plans are. And it's also the language that is weaponized to make people basically have these kinds of activities normalized. You know, when you look at Margaret Mead's fake, sexual activity in Samoa, what's the purpose for it? You know, well, it's plugged into the archaic revival. It's plugged into the attack against the culture that Western civilization had, which had family, single family, monogamous relationships as the foundation.
It's just like here when anthropologist Marlene Dobkin de Rios states, I don't remember what book it's from. It's in my article, though, in Theugen's What's in a Name? Psychedelic substances like ayahuasca create a state of hypersuggestibility in which persons are very open to being influenced by others. Many traditional cultures have utilized this condition to inculcate cultural values and behaviors in young people as they receive initiation into adulthood. In the West, countercultural values can be inculcated in young people when using these psychedelics, especially when using them in an antinomian context. An antinomian means of or relating to the view that that Christians are released by grace from the obligation of observing moral law. So that's exactly what we're talking about. And they state it, you know, Marlene de Rios, she's one of the leading anthropologists who popularized ayahuasca. She puts it right in your face that that's what they're doing.
Exactly. Good point. I mean, I can hear her writing a song with the frame, when are they going to let us build a better world? You know, I mean, it's just really clear that they were selling this fairy tale about a debased culture as something that was progressive, right? And yet it was just obviously...
Well, because it's this backward psychopathic mentality that you have to get rid of everybody else by creating a massive dystopia so that you can then somehow rein in your utopia.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like the workers' paradise comes after, the proletariat revolution where everybody dies.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's all the same thing, but never mind that all you do is make everybody damn suffer, including your own, while you push everybody down. I mean, it's like we all have to suffer the sloth at the grocery store checkout or wherever we are, you know, there's somebody who's just barely functional and hypnotized going like this or whatever. We all have to deal with that. When I don't remember things being near this bad when I was a kid, but you know, even talking about that, they'd be cheering and rah rah, look at us, look how great our utopian engineering skills are, or dystopian engineering skills.
Yeah, I noticed that they're trying to promote the social value and normalization of autism.
Yeah,
they have a couple shows on I've seen are pretty shocking where they try to, you know, present people, who have mental retardation, and then just focus on their lives and on their struggle and that how they're heroes and, you know, how their life is really very valuable.
It's National Autism Awareness Month, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I just did a show on it.
Yeah. Last week.
Last week with April. Yeah, exactly, and they're trying to normalize it. Of course, what they don't want you to know is they're the ones creating it, and that autism has doubled in the last like 10 or 15 years, and they claim to be fighting against it, but clearly they're exacerbating it and making it worse. Otherwise, you know, we would see the numbers going down. It's like the American Heart Association. The whole time they've been involved in things, heart disease has gotten worse and worse and worse and worse, and you know, everything else is the same thing. And
it's like how they were defending the black family.
Right. Yeah.
Society programs. Right. There was an example where
black macho, et cetera,
that had been going positive for 100 years suddenly turned absolutely south and fell off a cliff until the black family disappeared. All the while they were going, hey, all we're doing is trying to help.
Well, you know, oh yeah, and in the meantime, everybody suffers for the last 80 years because they destroyed the black family, you know, and look at the damage it's done to the inner cities, et cetera, and, you know, to the whole culture. So, you know,
they hit them both sides. They've got the pimp films, the rap music on one side, that then they're pushing drugs into the community.
And right? Guns. Yeah. Yeah.
Guns, and they're going, look, you know, so they say, well, you know, we really want to help here, so we're going to need a penal system that can incorporate, that can incarcerate, like, you know, some enormous fraction of the male population. That's really helping the family structure, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, when in the 1940s, what was black divorce rate, like 7% or something like that, and they had a very strong family background, and we didn't see, you know, I mean, if you go
song, it's demographics too.
Yeah, I mean, you listen to the music of the 40s, it depicts every, you know, the same thing as well. And then you jump forward to today, or how about the gangster rap, you know, and you jump forward from then and you contrast the two, and you can see, you know, the destruction. It's all about gang banging and drugs and hoes and everything, when, you know, previously it was all about respect and family and love and sweetheart and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, and see, Jacob, this is why, you know, we really need to become an army of researchers. You can see that Jan and I are pretty, you know, far along in our, you know, just as we relate to the information, you know, because we've been doing it for so many years. But it is critical that we become an army of researchers. And so, you know, there is just so much to uncover and to give to the public. We had Jason Horsley, I believe is his last name.
Yep.
Okay. Very fascinating story. Really articulate guy. Really good research. And Jacob, this is it's just wonderful to have you on the show now. I just feel like we're on the right path here.
I'm honored to be here. I mean, I hopefully I'm of some help.
Oh yeah, man,
was it a complete disaster? Connected to you guys.
It's just like the thing is, you've got to come back on, and we yak too much. I really want to. You see, the first time you're on these shows, it's disorienting. You know, it's hard to kind of like organize exactly what you want. And I mean, you can sit there and write a gigantic speech, but that takes so long. And, you know, you really want to be able just sort of to flow with kind of the bouncing off of ideas that everyone
exactly.
Else.
Yeah.
And that's just a hard thing to do because, of the first time. So you have to come back on, and then we're going to actually go through Harrison and take him all the way to the end. I mean, because I would really like to have like a more detailed description of Harrison's early life, the anthropology that he claims to have, and then how he then goes into mass observation. Because, you know, Jan and Jacob, I mean, to me, just that trajectory stinks. I mean, it absolutely stinks. You've got this guy who's there working anthropology against the natives, you know, in Borneo during World War II. And then this guy is into mass observation, controlling this thing, which is an obvious government anthropologic technique. You see what I mean?
Yeah, there's actually a really good connection we can make right now to his early childhood, to his study of anthropology. And that is... when his family dropped him off, because he was born in Argentina.
Yeah.
And I think when he was at the age of six, this family brought them back to England and left them at boarding school and went back to Argentina. He did not want to socialize with any of his classmates, any of his schoolmates. He did not have any interest in them whatsoever, other than to study them, get all their names and index them, and catalog all their activities. He wanted to study them at a very young age. And that kind of a mind is very rare, and there's a lot of power in that. And there could be also, not saying he is, but if you look at some of the people who worked with him, there could be some psychopathy associated to that as well. Just the amount of level of detail and high order thinking that he had at such a very young age, I mean, it's remarkable.
Yeah, and also it could be programming. In other words, you know, they when you look at like the Huxleys, and see, this is why when you study these kind of guys, you got to go into their family. Because if you look at the Huxleys, you've got generational malfeasance. Now look at like Jim Morrison, the guy in the Doors who puts on the claim that he's you know, an Indian comes into him, right, a shamanic, and then he's out promoting LSD to the teenagers. Well, then you look at his father and you see this guy's involved in the Gulf of Tonkin. He was the admiral, right? You know, running the whole. So now you have the conjecture is obvious that Morrison was trained very young, right? He wasn't like, you know, when he was suddenly 18, where you go, hey, Jim, we're going to make you this rock star. He could have been, in fact, I'm sure, because I know he was studying books. Some of the books that he was studying when he was at UCLA are kind of known. He was into Satanism, right? Well, I'm telling you, this he's already at 18, fully mature as far as, you know, the program that he's going to be involved with. So the training had to start at a really young age. And with Harrison, I would have loved to see, this is why, you know, you study them, you study their youth, and then we go backwards and see what his parents, if his parents can be connected into secret society activity.
I think his dad was an engineer, and then he went into the military, I think, after that.
Yeah, how did Harrison end up in Borneo at 19 or whatever it was?
That was through his work with ornithology, because he had organized a study where they had put a census on, was it the spotted grebe was the name of the bird, I believe. And because it gained so much recognition and wrote a book, he was able to organize an expedition, I believe, through Oxford University.
Okay.
And they funded the trip and sent him and a team that he had set up to meet a researcher who was already stationed out there.
Now, there's something else going on here with ornithology as well as zoology. Of course, Julian Huxley was a zoologist, but guess who else studied ornithology? It was Gordon Wasson.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Wasson.
Wow.
Yeah, Wasson was big into studying ornithology, and you know, I've got a bunch of his notes and stuff talking about it.
They love
birds first to speak in the language of the birds.
What's that? What were you saying?
We talk about the shadow organizations and type languages and stuff like that. You know, the couple of birds that are perched up speaking in the language of birds.
Yeah,
because they have their own language. And we don't, well, we just hear singing. We don't hear the lyrics for what they actually are.
Right.
Absolutely right. Exactly. See, this is the thing. The language of the oligarchs is what we need to understand. And it's visible in this research. Maybe not exactly this, you know, every single symbol, but you can, when you look at the idea that's being put out that Harrison's poem, the, you know, A Philosophy of Cannibalism, just accidentally is on the same page that Monge is declaring the existence of mass observation. Nah, I don't think so.
Yeah, to quote Dave McGowan, that's serendipitous, I believe, correct?
<That's> right.
Because remember, if you get into the poem, you're talking about a dying race, a race that dies, a race of cannibalism. Man, if you're making jokes about Christians as cannibals, and you're into a secret society that is going to destroy this particular culture, well, doesn't the whole poem suddenly make sense symbolically, right? So, you know, okay, it's a stretch. It's possible that it's just a coincidence, but then you get into context, you know, and you can't have too many coincidences inside a strong context, because otherwise, you know, it's like Gloria Steinem, you know, the Chester Bowles scholarship, right? Well, yeah. She's the only person that ever got it, and she got it to go to Poland, where she was a member of the CIA. Well, I think makes a little more sense to think that this was just a way to give her money, right, from the agency, right?
Sure.
So you see, the context creates coherency. When the context makes the interpretation of these things suddenly really more coherent, then you're on a good analytic path. And that's the thing here, is you know, this poem just shouldn't have existed right next to mass observation, right? Which then leads, it's a way that the counterculture helps get set up. So very suspicious to me.
It's a good way to get people.
We've only got a few seconds left here.
Okay. Jacob, can you come back anytime soon?
I'd love to be back on the show.
Well, this would be great if you could come back. I hope we have like maybe next week, because I feel we didn't really get into some of the questions I had. And and hopefully next time we'll have less technical issues. I think I'm going to get some headphones like Jan, and then I can unplug them.
Yeah, I also...
Thank you so much, Jacob.
Thank you.
If you want to contact me, go to caesarsmessiah.com. Jan, how do people reach you?
Gnosticmedia.com. Please support the show. Please donate. Jacob, any contact information for you or no?
I don't have any websites or anything. You can probably find me on Facebook through Jan. Otherwise, if you need to send me an email, you can send it to jacobdoolman@gmail.com. I believe, I don't think there's a dot between that. I think it's just jacobdoolman@gmail.com.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. Thanks, audience.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. Talk to you later.
Take care. Good night.